Scott Ross. One day, all DJs will be like this. Sonic Go!
An absolute classic there from half a century ago, would you believe? That was, of course, Love Affair, who hit the number one spot with that song in February 1968. And if all the technicalities are working okay, I hope to have Steve Ellis, who was the lead singer of Love Affair, on the line now. Are you there, Steve? Now, I'm hoping that this time Steve is there. Can we hear you, Steve? Ah, here we are. We got you.
You finally got me.
Yeah, it's working. I don't believe it.
You are obviously very, very, very together with technology.
Yeah, yes, me and technology really do go well together. I had to actually ring the boss and say, well, what's wrong? Do you know what? He said, well, I don't know. Anyway, we'll start all over again. Welcome to Phoenix FM, Steve. Right. Now, I know you've got this this new album and single out, but before we get onto that, I'd really like to take you back to the earliest days of Love Affair, and indeed before that, because you started singing in a band at the tender age of 15, but I presume that was not Love Affair.
I'm sure you asked me this before.
Yes. I did. When you could, yeah. Now you're really getting at me.
Yes, indeed. The drummer was 14, and we all still at school.
Yeah.
And we rehearsed. Every opportunity we got, we rehearsed in a warehouse in Walthamstow.
Yeah.
We got better and better and better and better, and we played anywhere. We would play. Weddings, you name it, we played it. We even gave crash bar mitzvahs because the drummer was Jewish and his friends would say, "Is my mitzvah up the road?" We had a band and we'd just turn up and say, "We're the band you booked." And they said, "We didn't book band. Or we'd play for free.
Did you get away with it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. About four or five times, yeah. And so we ended up, 1966, I was 16.
Uh-huh.
We played the Marquee.
Wow.
Residency at the Marquee. The Flamingo, where we had to pretend we were 18, otherwise they'd have got troubles. And then 66, we ended up supporting the Small Faces at the Albert Hall. That was sort of...
What, when you were 16?
Yeah.
Good God.
That was for the Aberfan disaster in Wales.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
With, who else was it? Gene Chandler, I think, was on as well. Anyway, distant memory, but a good one.
That's incredible. And but you made your first record, I believe, with this other band, or at least it's maybe Love Affair under an earlier name, is that right?
Yeah, there was a couple of different members in the band, but... There was a lot of jostling about the name, and I was quite happy with Soul Survivors, but I got outvoted basically by the management.
As you do.
As managers always seem to get their own way when you're young and stupid. But we made the Dire record, a cover version of a Rolling Stones record, which I didn't want to do because it just didn't suit us. And Tony Black, we took it up to the BBC, Tony Blackburn played it, and made my mum very happy, and then it sunk.
Oh dear,
but
shame.
I wasn't really bothered, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So it was like, thank God for that. Because it wasn't us, you know. I don't think it would have been successful, because it wasn't very good, but if it had been, it would have been, it would have completely wrong-footed us, you know.
Now then you went on to change the name to Love Affair, and you had some fantastic hits around the end of the 1960s. Now, apart from Everlasting Love, which we heard before I had the technical problems, and some of the other great hits, of course, were bringing on back the good times, Everlasting Love and Rainbow Valley. And yet, just a year after you hit the top spot, you decided to quit. What on earth made you do that when the world was at your feet? All the girls are worshipping you. What happened?
No, what you have to understand is, like, 15 to 19 is 4 years. So I was in that band for 4 years, and I left that band in Christmas 1969.
Hmm.
We played Mayfair, Newcastle, Mayfair, Boreham and Newcastle, and I couldn't do it anymore. You couldn't hear what you were playing.
Right.
The rest of the band wanted to go prog rock, and I didn't.
Uh-huh.
So I sort of stuck to sort of soul rock, blues, folk, up the broad spectrum. But Sony said they're quite happy for me to do what I wanted as a solo artist, so I did a solo album, and then which was really good, and got put out a couple of years back. I lost the tapes, but at the time I asked the boss at Sony. I said, "Look, can I put this on the shelf and get a band together?" And he went, "Yeah, if you wish. You know, it's a good album, but you know, if you want, that's what you want to do." So I got a band together and committed commercial suicide.
So I've got to ask you, if you had your time over again, would you do it again the same way?
What, you mean, would I leave?
Would you leave Love Affair jump out on your own?
Yeah, I think, with the benefit of hindsight, what I probably would have done, and I did have quite a lot of offers
from
bands to join them, what I should have done is perhaps left the band and joined another band that was more sort of my sort of liking.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do this prog rock stuff. It wasn't me. I couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing 1342 time and all that. Not my thing.
Now, whilst you remained pretty active in the industry, I think you'd probably agree that you were never quite so visible within the mainstream pop. So, what were you up to? Because, as you mentioned, you created your own band, Ellis.
Yeah.
I think with Zoot Money, wasn't it?
Yeah, Zoot. I still pals with Zoot. Still speak to him all the time. Sometimes I tour with him. Sometimes he plays with the Animals.
Yeah.
Depths for Mickey Gallagher, who's their permanent player, and Mickey's also in the Blockhead. So sometimes Zoot depths him, and we catch up. But I still phone him once every sort of 2-3 weeks, see if he's all right. he's a good lad, a good mate. So anyway, to answer your question, so Ellis went for a couple of years, then I joined that sort of Commercial Suicide, two albums. I don't really know what happened there.
Yeah.
The first one was produced by Roger Daltrey, mate of mine.
Yes.
One was produced by Mike Vernon from Blue Horizon, you know, Peter Green and all that. So the music kind of held up, and we played to universities and everything, but there was no great sort of sales, you know, not my department. We're out on the road playing all the time.
Yeah.
So that kind of fell to the wayside because Zoot got an offer to join, I think it was Kevin Ayers or something, and Davey got an offer to join T-Rex, and a couple of other guys, different bands, Andy, Thin Lizzy, and they weren't sort of beyond the back about it. We just sat down and talked about it, and I said, look, no dramas, we're not getting anywhere here with this, the way things are, so we just parted ways, still sort of stayed mates, and I went on, joined a rock band called Widowmaker.
Right.
It was like a hard rock band, and toured with The Who and Nazareth and Uriah Heep, and toured America with ELO.
When Crikey. They were
at their height with Jeff Lynne and Bev.
Yeah.
And then came back from that, which was probably about 78, something like that, I suppose. Did a solo album, which got shelved because the producers had a legal wrangle. I don't know what happened. And I just thought, I've got to walk away from this for a while because I've been since I was 15.
Yeah.
I need to take stock, really. And so I got a normal job.
Which was?
A docker. My neighbour next door said, my father-in-law is in charge and on the docks. I said, yeah, if that happens, I do. I said, I get fit. And I did get really fit until somebody dropped 2 tonne of forklift blades on my feet.
And you're going to tell me that the forklift truck won?
I certainly did, yeah.
Were you badly injured? You must have been, I guess.
Well, yeah, my feet were sort of like both broken in half from the middle.
Oh, my God.
Well, you can't argue against 2 tonne of metal, really.
Well, not terribly well.
No, so...
So I bet that made you hopping mad.
Oh, made me more than hopping mad. The pain you wouldn't believe. Anyway, setting that aside quickly, 6-odd years in and out, bone grafts and all the rest of. And then took up karate, as you do.
Crikey, you've had an interesting life, haven't you?
I thought, I know what I'd feel. And I took my daughter and she took to it like all.
Yeah.
And, so I thought, I might as well go as well. And then my other daughter went. And it was just a madness. But that was great. That was fantastic. So I got my mobility back. And then my pal said, you're going to get back on the music? I went, now my feet are good, So I put a band together, went out, toured non-stop for about 10, 12 years. Which takes us up to about, I don't know, 2001 or something.
Crikey.
Nothing really stopped, apart from the odd Kenny Everett incident.
What was that? What was that?
It was a joke. Oh,
sorry.
Kenny Everett, and he always cutting himself.
Oh, yeah.
Comedy.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there you go. So, and then what did I do then? Did an album. And then go back to it again, did another album.
So go. Now this year, of course, is obviously a special one for you, being the 50th anniversary of your first number one single with Love Affair. And as mentioned at the start of our chat, you've just released a new album in celebration of this. So tell us a bit about that.
In essence, what happened was I was in Brighton, downtown, in a record shop, and I met a couple of, I met this guy and his wife, and we just got talking like you do, and I bumped into him. I saw him in his shop, and then I went to see my pal in another shop, and they were in there. I said, I just saw you in a record. And we got talking. He said to me, are you Steve? I went, yeah. He said, I can't believe it. He said, you're in the band, blah blah. And we got talking for about an hour.
Yep.
an acoustic soul band, and they are really nice people, and they've become really good friends of mine now. And I said, I'd do a track with you. And he said, really? I went, yeah, so I'd do a track with you. So Mark phoned me up 3 weeks later, sent me a load of stuff and tracks and songs. She phoned me up about 3-4 weeks later. I picked a couple of tunes, did split A side, them one side, me the other side. And I said, where do you want to do this? In Black Barn. I said, that's Paul's, Paul Willis' studio. He said, yeah. He said, I don't advertise the fact that he's my cousin. I said, I don't believe it. So I went up to Black Barn because Paul's about, because it's Mark's record. And
yes.
He's playing on it as well. So Paul had inadvertently, accidentally, it all happened very, very yogurt knitting. You know what I mean?
Yogurt knitting.
No,
it's an unusual expression.
It was all kind of a bit strange in that Paul had sent me a track to put a vocal on. In the interim, anyway, aside from it all, I did nothing to do with Mark and Cal. I didn't even know that they were related. So when I was there, Paul said, why don't you stick the vocal on that track? Because we'd worked, he'd sent me the backing track and the fiddle about, and I'd written some lyrics, and he'd written a bit of it, and blah, blah. So I did that, and then, because we'd already done Cal's single.
Yeah.
And Paul said, why don't you do your album here? And he'd already asked me a couple of times, but it was, weren't aligned because he was out on tour, I was out on tour, or the studio was busy, one thing or another. Anyway, so then Paul sort of got involved with that in the best possible way. And so he's on about half of it, probably. He pulled in a couple of his band, and then I got Mark and Max from Cal, and my pal Kev from Dream Foundry.
Yeah,
it's like a core studio band, and then we got for live, putting down live, and then we got Mike Darbo track. Mike sent me a piano track down through the ether, which you like, you know, the computer.
Yep. And that's right. I haven't done the dig.
No, no technology. So it's like people make records now. Like, one's in America, one's in England. They haven't met each other in life. But anyway, so Mike's an old mate of mine. Mike sent me a track down I wanted to do his, and a couple of other things that I was working on. Anyway, and then it all sort of came together. So we did three days. We had it all wrapped up and mixed in 12 days.
And what's the new album called?
Boom Bang Twang.
Is there a story about that name?
Not really. We finished the album. We finished mixing it. We're all sat there like, the boys, Paul's band, Paul, Cal, Kev from Dream Foundry, what should we call this? And I just went, boom, bang, twang. What's that mean? I said, bass, drums, guitar. It'll mean what you want it to mean. It can mean anything you like. So everybody went, yeah, that's a good one. We'll use that. So we did.
Now, because this album includes, as you've hinted, a mix of new material and covers, including your new single, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying, which, of course, is an old Jerry and the Pacemakers number written by Jerry Marsden. I understand he's had some very complimentary things to say about this version.
Jerry, yeah, well, I've toured with Jerry I've worked with Jerry across the years on occasion, like in Europe and that.
Yeah.
Festival things. I've done a couple of tours with him in the last 4 years, you know,
yeah,
quite fairly big tours, and we get on really well. So what happened was, a pal of mine called Terry Reed, great singer, he was the guy that turned down Led Zeppelin, put Robert Plant up for it. And Terry's a great singer, and I went to Terry lives in San Francisco. He came over here, and I went to see him play, and he did it live, and I thought, do you know what, I've always liked this track. And then, of course, I've listened to you every night for about 30 dates.
Yeah.
And I said, Jerry, I'm going to do this. I'm going to cover this track of yours. Is that all right? He went, of course it is. Yeah. So I sent him a demo, finished, rough, and he liked it. And then I've polished it up and sent him the finished, and he really, really likes it. His wife likes it too.
Yeah.
So it's nothing like his version. It's like my own take on it, you know?
Well, good that's song. Good stuff.
It's a good song. You can't beat a good song if the song is good. I mean, Ray Charles did it many years ago. You can't, you cannot odds it. You've got to record good songs.
Absolutely.
It's a good, you know, I think it's a really good song.
Well, look, thanks very much for talking to us this afternoon, Steve, and thanks for putting up with my technical shenanigans.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. I've got a Nokia phone that only takes 20p, so don't you worry.
Well, look, good luck with the new album and the single. I've got a bit of advice for you, though. Keep away from the docks.
Yeah,
don't disappear again.
I'm going to be a faultless, right? I'll get this,
twinge. I'm not surprised.
My toes come on a turf. Turn up a little bit.
You've still got toes to turn up.
Brentwood.
Yeah, we're in Brentwood, yeah.
Well, come on, you bees, that's it, isn't it?
Sorry?
Come on, you bees, that's right.
Yes, that's it.
You're obviously not enthralled.
No, not terribly.
Oh, right, okay.
Anyway, let's take a listen to the new single, and I think you should introduce it for us.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this show, and especially Scott's endeavours into the world of the internet and so forth.
Well, it's not the internet, it's just trying to get phones working.
This is true. I shouldn't do it anymore anyway. Anyway, this is a track off my new album. If you like it, you can listen to it on YouTube, or you can actually go and buy it somewhere in HMV or on Amazon or anything. Hope you enjoy it. It's called Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying.
Thanks, Steve.
Summer. Don't let the sun
Yeah, the new song there from Steve Ellis, Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. And thanks very much to Steve for talking to us just now.